I think we should start up. Let me welcome all of you to the second of our Lenten lectures in this series, arranged by the Cold War Studies Center here at the LSE, on the topic from the Cold War to the War on Terror. My name is Arne Westad. I'm co-directing the center with Professor Michael Cox. And it's a great pleasure for us tonight to welcome Professor Mary Kellner as our speaker. Mary really needs no introduction at LSE. She is the Professor of Global Governance and Director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance here at the school. And she is someone who has a past that really connects the present to the history of the Cold War, both as a scholar and as an activist. She is someone whose work, I think, has been a great inspiration to everyone who is working today on connecting present-day concerns with the further study of the Cold War and its repercussions. She's written a number of books about Cold War and about present security concerns. Her two latest books are New and Old Wars and Global Civil Society, An Answer to War. It's a great pleasure, Mary, to have you here today, and we're very, very grateful that you are willing to speak to us. Please.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm really enthusiastic about this initiative of yours to establish a Cold War Studies Centre here at LSE. And so I'm very, very proud and pleased to be speaking at your first series of lectures. The Cold War Studies Centre, I have to say, to start with, gave me this all-embracing title. It wasn't my title. Old Wars, New Wars, Cold War, War on Terror. And I thought, shall I invent my own title, or shall I rise to the challenge?
I thought it sounded so good.
Well, it does sound very good, but it kind of embraces my entire life's work. So I thought, can I fit it all into one lecture? And I decided to try. But if you think this lecture is too packed and too detailed, blame them. That's my sort of apology at the beginning. Or not exactly apology. Qualification. Well, I'm going to take as my starting point the day, which I'm sure you all remember, when President Bush stood on the USS Abraham Lincoln, May 2003, with this huge, he was wearing uniform fatigues, with this huge backdrop, mission accomplished. And it was the end of the Iraq War. And he talked, actually, about the arrival of a new era. He claimed that the United States had discovered a new form of warfare that, through exploiting information technology, is more rapid, precise, and low in casualties than ever before. The coalition forces, said Bush, toppled the Iraqi regime with a combination of precision, speed, and boldness that the enemy did not expect and the world had not seen before. Well, I think that the war in Iraq is indeed a new kind of war, and it does indeed make use of new technologies, ranging from satellite systems to internet to mobile phones. But what I mean by new war is quite different from President Bush. What I mean by new war doesn't have to do with technology, but with the social relations of warfare. I'm talking about a new type of warfare associated with globalization and with the disintegration of states, as, for example, in the Balkans or in Africa. And what I want to argue in this lecture is that it's important to identify new wars in these terms if we are to try to solve some of the problems that we face in the world today. I'd argue that, and what I want to argue now is that both the Cold War and the War on Terror actually resemble not new wars, but what I call old wars. They are, if you like, reconstructions of old war, using new technology. And my main argument is that this insistence on viewing the conflicts through an old war lens is a huge obstacle to solving many of today's deep-rooted problems. In other words, successive American administrations continue to behave as though they're fighting World War II, but the real conflicts of today in the Balkans, Africa, or Iraq are very different. So let me start by explaining my distinction between old and new wars. Then I want to talk about the Cold War and the War on Terror and why they have to be understood as imaginary reruns of old war. And finally, I'm not going to say a lot about new wars, actually, but I'm going to say what a new war analysis, looking at things differently, might imply about an alternative strategy. Old war refers, the term Old War refers to an idealized version of war that characterized Europe between the late 18th century and the middle of the 20th century. Old War is war between states fought by armed forces in uniform where the decisive encounter is battle. Old wars, as Charles Tilly has convincingly argued, were linked to the rise of the modern nation state and were state building. States made war, and war made the states, said Tilly. In wars, states, modern states, were gradually able to monopolize organized violence, to eliminate private armies, brigands, feudal levies, and so on, to establish professional forces wearing uniforms subservient to the state. Taxation and borrowing was increased, as was administrative efficiency and public services. And above all, the concept of political community was forged. Imagined communities based on the development of newspapers and novels in vernacular languages through which people who speak the same language come to see themselves as part of one community were consolidated in war. Carl Schmitt, the German political theorist, writing in the 1930s, talked about the concept of the political that underlies the modern state. For him, intrinsic to the concept of the political is the friend-enemy distinction. And he says that has to be linked to the real physical possibility of killing. The job of the state was to defend territory against others, and it was this job that gave the state legitimacy. Protecto ergo obligo, I protect, therefore I'm obeyed, says Schmitt, is the cogito ergo sum of the state. Old wars were fought according to certain rules, at least in theory, codified in the late 19th century in the Geneva and Hague Conventions, rules about minimizing civilian casualties, treating prisoners well, and so on. And I think these rules were critical to establishing the legitimacy of wars. There's really a fine line between legitimate killing and murder. And legitimate killing by the state was hedged in by all kinds of rules. Of course, the rules weren't obeyed, but the fact that soldiers felt themselves to be heroes and not criminals was part of the whole legitimacy of what was taking place. Now, what I call new wars are just the opposite. These are wars that take place in the context of the disintegration of states, typically authoritarian states under the impact of globalization, what people now call failing states. These are wars fought by networks of state and non-state actors, often without uniforms. Sometimes they have little distinctions like crosses or Ray-Ban sunglasses. These are wars where battles are rare, where most violence is directed against civilians through counterinsurgency, for example, or ethnic cleansing. They're wars where taxation and income is falling and war finance consists of loot, pillage, illegal trade, and other forms of war-generated revenue. And above all, these are wars which exacerbate the disintegration of the state. They contribute to declines in GDP, loss of tax revenue, loss of legitimacy. They contribute, and this is really important, to new sectarian identities. Indeed, I argue that this is the purpose of these wars. If you like, they recreate the friend-enemy distinction in a divisive way. The whole point of these wars is actually less to, say, capture territory as it is to manufacture fear and hatreds, to create a new divisive sense of political community. Now, of course, these wars aren't entirely new. Of course, there were wars like this in the pre-modern period. There were wars like this outside of Europe through most of the Old War period. There were even elements of this kind of war. None of the old wars really and truly conformed to this image. There were even elements of this in what we classically think of as old wars as well. The point of the distinction is because it helps our understanding of what's happening today and what we need to do about it. Now, old wars reached their apex in the middle of the 20th century. The application of science and technology to killing, the increased destructive, the increased mobilization capacities of state led to a destruction on a scale that today is absolutely unimaginable. When you think of the figures, it's very hard to comprehend. 15 million people killed in World War I, 50 million people killed in World War II. In a few weeks in Auschwitz, as many people were killed as were killed, say, in the recent tsunami, or in the whole of the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Or you could talk about the effects of the bombing in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Tokyo, Dresden. In a single night, between 100 to 200,000 people were killed. Moreover, over half of those killed were civilians. So out of the experience of these wars came really the apex of the nation state, came centralized, totalizing states, blocks of states, actually. When Orwell wrote 1984, which was this chilling description of a permanent war between blocks, he was actually not thinking of the Soviet Union. He was thinking of post-war Britain. 1984 was 1948, the wrong way around. He was writing in 1948. And above all, the war introduced a new concept of the political that extended beyond the state to blocks of nations. The idea of democracy against totalitarianism, or socialism against fascism. And what I want to argue in the rest of this lecture is that both the Cold War and the War on Terrors are ways of keeping this idea of old war linked to political community alive. That old war ways of seeing the world run very deeply in the discourses of politicians, which prevents them from seeing the reality of new wars. Now, my way of understanding the Cold War is as imaginary war. I wrote a book called Imaginary War. It used to be said in Europe during the Cold War, that we had experienced peace since the end of the Second World War. My feeling is that this, as someone who lived through that period, I was born in 1946, that this was very much a misnomer. What we actually lived, quite apart, in fact, from the fact that there were real wars in Hungary or Czechoslovakia or in large parts of the world, that somehow we thought were limited because they weren't the kind of total horrible war that we'd experienced in the past. We actually lived as though we were at war, with millions of men under arms, at higher levels of military spending than ever before experienced in peacetime, constant military exercises, spy stories, hostile propaganda, and above all, we lived with much of the anxiety and fear associated with war, as well as the organization of defense industries, the centralized state, and, of course, the friend-foe distinction that defined the world into ideological camps and sort of provided a mechanism for discrediting opposition. Throughout the period, the Cold War was seen as a mighty ideological clash, a great divide, as Deutscher put it, between democracy and totalitarianism, or between capitalism and socialism, depending on where you stood. And I would actually argue, not only was this idea, this global clash, was a way of defining political community within each bloc, the Cold War suited both sides. I mean, I think World War II actually solved a lot of problems faced both in the West and in the East in the previous period. It solved the problem of mass unemployment, it solved the problem of economic nationalism in the West, and in the East it solved the problem of loss of legitimacy and the inefficiency of the bureaucratic state. It was forced to become efficient when it had to fight the Second World War. And so what the Cold War did was, what World War II did was to somehow solve those problems. It mobilized everybody, it solved the problems of unemployment, Lend-Lease was provided so countries didn't have to be economically nationalist, and the Soviet Union became a more efficient system. And so the Cold War reproduced those solutions. And in a way, I think, both left and right colluded in this idea. The right, as I've said, described the war as a conflict between democracy and totalitarianism. And I think the left discredited themselves by describing it as a conflict between capitalism and socialism. They were somehow seen as apologists for the Soviet system, which made it very easy to marginalize them. I don't want to suggest that the Cold War as imaginary war was somehow a conscious conspiracy to make us feel afraid. What I want to say is it was the result of their experiences in World War II. It was a result of the state structures that had been established during that period. If you analyze, for example, the evolution of the arms race during the Cold War, it's much better explained on each side as though they were actually arming against a phantom German enemy than against each other. Just to give you some examples, the Americans continued to emphasize strategic bombing. And with the advent of missiles, nuclear weapons were seen as a continuation of strategic bombing, and they were placed under strategic air command. What the US envisaged was a conventional blitzkrieg across the German plains, and the US would rush to the aid of the Europeans with the help of their superior know-how. The Russians, on the other hand, never did strategic bombing. Actually, they regarded it as a fascist tactic. And they believed there was no alternative to conventional ground forces. Aircraft were seen as assisting ground forces. Stalin called them the handmaiden of artillery. So when missiles were developed, they were seen as artillery and placed under the command of the Artillery Academy. Actually, of course, these different forms of behavior help to reinforce each other, but my point is that the natural thing to do when there wasn't actually a war was to look at the past, learn lessons from the past, think about how you might have done it better. Nor do I want to suggest that there was symmetry. Many people in the West supported the Cold War and benefited from it. But I think the imposition of Stalinism was a tragedy for Central Europe and was, I believe, sustained by the Cold War. And I'll say something about that later. Throughout the period, at least on the Western side, and I'm going to focus on the Western side simply because we want to talk about the war on terror. Throughout the period, at least on the Western side, there was always a problem of credibility. If war was purely imaginary, how long would enemies and friends continue to believe in American power? Astonishing numbers of nuclear weapons were accumulated during the 1950s and 1960s, enough to destroy the world many times over. Strategy, according to Clausewitz, is the use of military force for political objectives. But what, pondered the strategists like Schelling, did strategy mean if military force was too dangerous to be used? What if insurgents in Latin America or Southeast Asia were not deterred? And indeed, they were not. How could force be used in a limited way? Now, my answer was that strategy, as they perceived it, became the way in which you used force in an imaginary war. And the idea was everybody would look at this imaginary war and they would know what would happen. And therefore, it was a kind of power play. The arcane discussions in Europe about mutual assured destruction, flexible response, can only be understood in these terms. And I'd like to read you something from Richard Perle. Remember him, everybody? He's a figure of the present. But this is him writing in the Reagan period. I've always worried less about what would happen in an actual nuclear exchange than the effect the nuclear balance has on our willingness to take risks in local situations. It is not that I'm worried about the Soviets attacking the United States with nuclear weapons, confident that they will win that nuclear war. It is that I worry about an American president feeling he cannot take action in a crisis because Soviet nuclear forces are such that if escalation took place, they are better poised than we are to move up the escalation ladder. Sorry about the escalation ladder and all these terms, but what he's really saying is we're playing a game in our imagination, and that's what determines power today. Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or now the National Missile Defense, was supposed to protect America in the imagination. Children drew America surrounded by an astrodome with missiles bouncing off it. And the point was, again, so that America needn't fear being attacked if it were to use force. So it doesn't really matter, actually, that Star Wars or missile defense doesn't work. The point is whether the American president believes that it works and therefore is able to use military force. Of course, limited wars did take place. And in fact, there were great efforts to prove the credibility of American military force. And the most important of these limited wars was Vietnam. I think that the failure in Vietnam, and again, it was a horrendous war with many, many casualties, simultaneously strengthened popular feelings that war is unacceptable, that World War II can never be repeated, and at the same time fueled the preoccupation of military planners like Richard Perle with credibility and usability. So this, I think, is the context in which to understand the war on terror. I think what the Americans believe is that they have discovered a new form of warfare making use of information technology, the war, as I quoted from Bush, war that's rapid, precise, and low in casualty. War that is actually imaginary from an American point of view. Americans don't have to pay extra taxes. They don't have to risk their lives, or they risk very few. At least in theory, we can come back to that. What they do is to watch a kind of replay of World War II on television. And they can feel that America is leading a mission for democracy against terrorists and tyrants. Now, the origins of this new form of imaginary warfare, I think, actually go back to the rise of information technology and the lessons, actually, in part, of Vietnam in the 1970s and 80s. In Vietnam, actually, the attrition rate of aircraft was very high, Vietnamese using handheld Soviet rockets. And so there began a whole debate about whether the offensive, typical offensive maneuvers of World War II were still appropriate. There was something called the Military Reform School that argued that the West should abandon its offensive capacities and develop a defensive plan because while you could nowadays, it was very difficult to win offensively, by the same token, you can always defend yourself against attack sufficiently to leave room for negotiation. Well, the response of the traditional American military strategists was that information technology makes offensive maneuvers all the more powerful, because now you can use missiles, you can use unmanned aerial vehicles, you can swamp the defense with area destruction munitions, and so we need offensive maneuvers all the more. And for institutional, subjective reasons, they're the people that won. And what has come up has been a series, every decade there's been a new strategy, air, land, battle, and deep strike, with a strategy of the 1980s, which envisaged deep strikes against Soviet territory, and then follow-on force attack, as it was called. In the 90s, the big fashionable issue was the revolution in military affairs, which again imagined long-distance, precise strikes, and was actually tried out in Kosovo, in Libya. And of course, when President Bush came to power, we had the advent of Donald Rumsfeld with his theory of defense transformation, which was again much along the same line. I think what you can see is that although after the end of the Cold War military spending fell, nothing like what happened in the Eastern Bloc happened in the West. And military research and development remained more or less constant, which allowed the development both of follow-on technologies to the typical Cold War platforms and of the new technologies. Yet I think what you can say is that all these new strategies really represented information technology grafted on to traditional assumptions about the way that military forces should be used and traditional institutional structures. The methods have really not changed since World War II. They involve a combination of aerial bombardment at long distance and rapid offensive maneuvers. One interesting aspect of the new technology is virtual wargaming. The Defense Department, the US Defense Department, even recruits Hollywood producers to develop their worst case scenarios for these virtual games, such that James Dadarian now talks about what he calls MIMENET, the Military Industrial Entertainment Network. But I think that the end result of virtual wargaming is to make these kind of ideas even more subjective, because you feed in these stories that have come from the lessons of past wars. So it continues to look even more like a kind of linear version of World War II. I think one of the most quoted remarks of the Second World War was General William Wallace, in charge of the US Army units in Iraq, who said, "The enemy we're fighting is a bit different from the one we wargamed against." So what about the enemy? Well, long before 9/11, the wargamers were talking about the risks of what they called asymmetric threats, of terrorists, of rogue states that harbor terrorists. It was never quite clear why the revolution in military affairs or defense transformation was the best way to deal with these asymmetric threats. And indeed, when 9/11 happened, my first thought was, this is real. And when things are real in wars, you have to adapt your strategies. So since it's real, they'll have to adopt a different approach. They can't simply go back to the table and pick up defense transformation or the revolution in military affairs. But I was wrong. And I think, especially given the people around Bush, like I've already mentioned, Richard Perle or Dick Cheney, people who'd been schooled in the Cold War period, it was actually quite inevitable that this should have been their reaction, that their chosen response was a kind of reconstruction of World War II. 9/11 was immediately compared with Pearl Harbor. And like the Cold War, this idea of the war on terror is viewed as a powerful crusade, freedom against totalitarianism. Indeed, one of the things I find quite interesting is the way in which global Islam is dubbed as totalitarian. And awful, hideous, though, I think these ideologies are. For me, totalitarianism is intrinsically linked to the idea of an all-embracing state. It's very hard to think of a totalitarian non-state actor. And I think, as during the Cold War, some people on the left do actually help to collude in this idea, either by defending the resistance in Iraq, for example, or by explaining global Islam away in terms of global injustice. For us in Europe, of course, the war on terror is much less convincing than the Cold War. We knew much more than the Americans about the reality of communism, and we were closer to the memory of World War II. But I'm not sure this is true in America. And indeed, I think this may be the significance of Bush's re-election. The idea of the war on terror is, for many Americans, no less convincing than was the Cold War. And I think that is really the problem that we face. And even more, I suppose, the problem, of course, is that whereas the Cold War was, I suppose you could say, was imaginary, although, of course, it had a very dangerous reality too, the war on terror is very real if you live in places like Iraq. The invasion conformed to Bush and Rumsfeld's dreams. It was showy and dramatic and rapid. In fact, of course, the Iraqis didn't fight. What actually happened was that the Americans distributed leaflets saying, take off your uniforms and go home, and the army and the Republican Guard did just that. There was a very small-scale resistance for some of the sort of small irregular forces around Saddam Hussein, a group called Saddam's Martyrs. But really, I think, the invasion was more like an exercise. The Americans simply walked into Iraq, and I think that created incredible problems, because once they'd arrived, they behaved as though they'd won a great victory, as though this was the end of World War II, and they were occupying Iraq. Actually, they weren't occupying Iraq. They were in Iraq on the basis of the consent of the Iraqi people. But they behaved as though they were. They immediately dissolved the army, introduced a sweeping policy of de-Ba'athification on the model of denazification in Germany. They used Germany and Japan as their model for what they were going to do. And the effect of that was to humiliate and infuriate those very people who had consented to the invasion. So, in the end, what resulted from this attempt to do this kind of show in Iraq was not victory over an enemy, but state disintegration and new war. I mean, as a matter of fact, I think Iraq was much more close to state failure than was really realized, partly because both Saddam Hussein and President Bush had an interest in portraying the regime as a mighty totalitarian regime. But actually, the process of state disintegration was kind of condensed into a short period. And without going into great length about the character of the war, I think what's happening in Iraq is that the US is being dragged into a real new war. And I want to just say something about this on the American side, leaving aside the Iraqi side. First of all, because of the shortages of troops, the Americans have recruited these large numbers of private contractors. And so they are essentially not like an orthodox army. They, in fact, have become a kind of network of state and non-state actors. And as you saw in Abu Ghraib, very similar to new wars, you have a situation where the private contractors are much less constrained by the rules of war than the soldiers. Because, and of course this is the same with the Israelis in Palestine or the Russians in Chechnya, because you can't distinguish between combatants and civilians, the result is very high numbers of civilian deaths. Most of the majority of the casualties, 80%, in Iraq are civilian. And I was interested, I don't know if any of you watched Panorama last Sunday, but they produced statistics from the Iraqi Ministry of Health for the 3 months from August to November. Something like 3,000 civilians were killed in that period, the majority of them by American and coalition forces. Of course, the other side also direct violence against civilians. But then, you know, if you look at something like Fallujah, where the Americans go on in with the idea of defeating the enemy, the end result was the city was razed to the ground, the enemy disappeared, and something like 300,000 people were made refugees. Sadr City, very similar, it resulted in 3,000 casualties. And so the effect of that is, in fact, to consolidate the opposition in Iraq. I think there are very many different groups, and I'm not, for time reasons, I'm not going to go into them. And I actually think the extreme jihadists, the ones who do these grisly hostage takings and beheadings, the ones who are linked to Al-Qaeda, are a small minority. But the effect is to create a polarization in the world and to increase support for these kinds of extremist tendencies. And in a way, what it does is to give substance to the idea of the war on terror. So, what I really want to conclude by saying is that by thinking about new wars, not in technology terms, but in these kinds of ways, we come up with a very different approach about how to deal with these types of conflicts. And indeed, I would say, how to deal with terrorism in general. I don't want to suggest that terrorism is not a serious problem. In fact, I think it is serious, and I actually think it's too serious to be hijacked by these kinds of war games. This was actually, and this is where I go back to the Cold War, this was actually what I felt very strongly during the Cold War. I always had the feeling that the West were crying crocodile tears. Stalinism really was a totalitarian, oppressive system. But what the Cold War did, far from opposing it, was actually sustaining it. It provided an argument for the Stalinists for cracking down on opposition in Eastern Europe. So again, I think Stalinism was too serious to be dealt with by the Cold War. I think that World War II really did mark the end of old wars. I think wars of this type are just simply impossible because of the destructiveness of military technology. And they have become unacceptable and illegitimate. And that's, in a way, what the growth of peace movements and everything else illustrates. I think some people would say that the war between Iran and Iraq was an old war that took place in the 1980s. Well, if it was an old war, although actually it had quite a lot of new war characteristics, it was, in a sense, the exception that proved the rule, because it was very like World War I. It was immensely destructive. It led to total stalemate. Millions of young men were killed, and nothing changed at the end of it. So, and eventually it began to slide into a sort, it didn't, in the end, consolidate Iran and Iraq. Just the contrary. So it began to slide into a new war. Now, new wars deliberately violate all the conventions of old wars. The actual tactics, the violence against civilians, not only violate the old laws of wars, they also violate the new body of human rights legislation that has been built up since the Second World War. And so in my view, the key to dealing with new wars is the reconstruction of political legitimacy. If old wars, according to Schmidt, established a notion of political legitimacy in terms of the friend-enemy distinction, I think what happens in new wars is that the friend-enemy distinction destroys political legitimacy. What that means is that political legitimacy can only be reconstructed on the basis of popular consent and within a framework of international law. It means supporting efforts at democratization in difficult situations And it means using various international tools, including law, including civil society networking, to support such processes. Is there a role for military force? Yes, I think there is a role for military force to protect people and to uphold the rule of law. I mean, I do favour intervention in cases of humanitarian catastrophe, genocide, as in Rwanda. But at the same time, I don't think that can be done through classic war fighting. It can't be done through bombing. You can't protect people on the ground through bombing. I think you really have to rethink how you use military force. I don't have time to talk about this now. It's something I've been thinking about a lot. But I think what one has to think about is new defensive uses of forces which are aimed at prevention, protection, and stabilization rather than at victory. It's very difficult, but I think there are possibilities there. Now, of course, Carl Schmitt would have argued that there can be no political community without enemies, and that where force is used, he said, in the name of humanity, the adversary is no longer an enemy but an outlaw, a disturber of the peace. Now, if he's right about political community, then the future is very grim. Only a pervasive global new war seems to me to be possible. But if we actually believe that communities can be held together by reason rather than by fear, that fear isn't the only thing that holds people together, that people actually come together because they believe in creating communities and in creating rules, then I think you can envisage an alternative possibility. If you like, I think you could envisage, and I think it's what actually happens today in Europe, an alternative form of statehood that's not linked to war, and rather is linked to a multilateral framework. And I think that is what we're seeing nowadays emerging in this part of the world. Well, as for the argument about humanity, I think that there's something in that. I mean, if we dub the terrorist as an enemy, we give them political status, and that's exactly what Bush has done. So I think it's quite a good idea to see them, people who use violence in horrible ways, like in 9/11, as outlaws, as criminals, as disturbers of the peace, and to use the methods that you use, policing, intelligence, even in some cases military force, rather than the methods of old war. So let me conclude. What I've tried to show is that attempts to recreate old war prevent us from dealing with the realities of today's globalized world. Indeed, ideas of old war feed into and exacerbate real new wars taking place in Iraq and elsewhere. And I call them new, not because they're altogether new, but because we can only develop alternative strategies if we see how they differ from wars like World War II, Cold War, or the War on Terror. I think there's a huge security gap in the world today. Millions of people live in daily fear of political violence. And yet, our security conception, indeed the kind of thing I'm talking about, is often regarded as naive. Our security conceptions are drawn from the dominant experience of World War II, just can't do anything about this insecurity. On the contrary, as I've tried to show, they actually make things worse. So that's where I'll stop.
Thank you very, very much, Mary. Just have a short break while those who have to leave will leave, and the rest of you prepare some questions. We'll do a roughly 15 minutes of Q&A. Okay. Can everyone who'd like to remain for the Q&A please take their seats? We do have microphones both upstairs and down here. Where are the mics up? All right. Very good. I'll start with a quick question, Mary, really relating to the final part of your brilliant lecture, which has to do with the role of the state in the division lines that exist between old wars and new wars, and particularly the way peace can be created, or at least some form of stability can be created or recreated. Now, the American form of warfare, you saw both during the Second World War, and in my opinion, in many ways directly carried over to the Cold War, sets as its aim the unconditional surrender of the enemy. And there is really no alternative to that. There can be some form of stability, as happened during the Cold War, but there can be no peace. Now, all of that is, of course, connected to there being a state at the other end that will raise the white flag and say, we surrender. The war is over. And this, of course, what Bush tried to recreate, that memorable, or no, rather infamous moment on the aircraft carrier Lincoln, when he was trying to say, the war is over, we have won. And then the police operations are what remains. Now, in reality, of course, by doing that to many people, including people like Richard Pearl, he undermined some of the key concepts in the war, in the idea of the war of terror. So we had to roll back from that, to use a good Cold War term, fairly quickly. Now, I wonder how you see that problem. I mean, the difficulty here, of course, is that if you are dealing with a non-state actor, as you are with radical Islamism, how is it possible to use any of the instruments that you were talking about, including, you know, legitimacy, in order to get an end to hostilities? Won't there have to be some form of recognition on both sides, even with a broader movement, at least in ideological terms, as Islamism, that, you know, the end result would have to be in form of a negotiations rather than in terms of confrontation, but also on the American side, that there would have to be some form of contact for peace to be reestablished?
Well, certainly, I would argue that you can't use the practice of total victory in these situations. On the contrary, you simply can't win, for one thing, and this is what the Russians have discovered in Chechnya, it's what the Israelis have discovered in Palestine. Actually, the Israelis have been rather better at winning in military terms than the Russians have, but they've totally lost it in political. So that's a hopeless strategy. Then the question is then the only alternative negotiations? Well, I think when you're dealing with Al-Qaeda or al-Zarqawi in Iraq, that's very difficult too. There may be, I mean, Hamas may be different, and we're seeing now that Hamas is different. Most of the resistance in Iraq, I think, is probably different. I think most of them are former military. If you look at the analysis of the attacks, most of them are former military personnel, and the majority of their attacks are against American convoys. But I think there are some people you can't negotiate with. There are some people you do have to criminalize. And the only way to deal with those sorts of people is through policing, intelligence, and at the same time, you have to protect people from their attacks.
So what you see really is that it's a, you know, it's really a question about the terminology here, you know, the war on terror being a misnomer, as it were, and that what you would be looking for would be police operations dealing with this as international criminal activities.
Yeah, but sometimes police operations might require military forces. But yes, I would see it as a matter of law enforcement.
Okay, let's take some questions from the audience. Could indicate. Yep, we got one down here. So if you'd like to go first.
You said that the war between Iran and Iraq did not result in consolidation of a state on either side. I'm from Iran, and I can tell you that it did result in the consolidation of a state in Iran. Also, if a state is formed based on the ideals of Al-Qaeda, I think it would definitely be a totalitarian state, as we saw in the case of Taliban, which was very close to Al-Qaeda.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could say if they formed a state, it would be a totalitarian state, but this isn't the problem that we're facing at the moment. I mean, I think totalitarianism is about an expansionist totalitarian state, and this theory that Arendt and Brzezinski developed in the 1950s that encompassed both Nazism and Stalinism. So what I find is that this use of the word totalitarianism to describe Al-Qaeda is actually a way of trying to put the whole thing in a state-to-state context. On Iran, you may well be right. I was actually, I'm sure you know more than I do, but I suppose my point is that that's very different. Whether it consolidated or whether it led to disintegration, the point was that it ended in stalemate. Millions of deaths.
A question down here? Please.
On the Iraqi side, I think it did start the disintegration process.
You are talking about imaginary war and talk about American government use the Hollywood, something like that, and people would think it has great to do with the maybe Hollywood war films or something like that. Are you saying that the American regime has got something psychologically wrong or problem? This is one question. And the other is, how do you predict the war in Iraq? How long will be that American troops will withdraw from that country? What's your prediction? Thank you.
Predictions, Mary.
On the case of America, is America somehow... I mean, I think it's very difficult to say that, they're crazy or they're mad or whatever. I mean, from their own point of view, this is entirely rational. And this is a logical consequence of 50 years of Cold War. You have to remember that World War II was an extraordinary moment. I mean, on the one hand, 50 million people dead. On the other hand, an extraordinary victory. It created the modern American state. It created the modern American identity. It was their great, glorious moment. And in a sense, what the Cold War did was to extend, reconstruct, recreate all those institutions. And all of these people are schooled in those ideas. I don't think that Bush says, I'm going to impose a fantasy on America. I honestly believe he really believes the fantasy. Mm. He really believes he was destined to be a great war leader. Mm. Every politician in America wants to be Roosevelt. Every politician in Britain wants to be Churchill. And so they're always trying to find Churchillian moments. If you ask me why Blair went along with Bush, I honestly think it was because he was looking forward to that moment in Iraq when he would be greeted by cheering Iraqis, which is what he thought would happen. So I'm not trying to say that they invented. What I'm trying to say is that this is the way the institutions have thought. And it's very difficult for them to shift. And, you know, historically, there's always this tag that generals always fight the last war. And what happens is you fight the last war, you get defeated, and then either you change your tactics and win, in which case that becomes your dominant idea, or you fail and you lose. And that's basically what the Americans have done. They've gone on fighting the last war. As for your question about Iraq, I think predictions are really hard because I actually do think it depends on agency. I mean, I'm a great believer that people make their own history. And I do think that the elections were a success. I think that what they were, though, was a victory.
victory not for the Americans and the British, but a victory, a statement by the Iraqis that they wanted independence. And again, I think it would be only too easy for the Americans and the British to say that the elections legitimize our presence. And if they do, it will be a complete misreading. If, on the other hand, the new Iraqi government says this was a vote for independence, we want a timetable for withdrawal, we want to reach out to the Sunnis and have negotiations, then I think there is a real possibility of something different. I think it's going to be very, very difficult, because although I do think large numbers of the insurgents might be willing to negotiate, I do think that it's going to be incredibly difficult to deal with the Al-Zarqawis and these extremist types. So it's the optimistic scenario is quite a difficult one, and the pessimistic scenario, I'm afraid, is possibly a bit more likely, except for the fact that I think both the British and Americans would like an exit strategy. I mean, casualties are mounting. I mean, I gave you a picture that, and I believe that picture to be true, in that I've talked to journalists, for instance, who were in Fallujah, and American soldiers, unlike British soldiers, really do believe that what they're doing is good and right. But nevertheless, I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction growing among American reservists, as happened in Vietnam. And so it may be, and you know, when you look at the casualties, there have been, I think, something like 1,000 deaths, but there's been 10,000 serious wounded. So that will begin to have an impact in America.
Going back to the sort of negotiation question, I mean, if the end result of the election in Iraq is that within the, what seems to be an almost certainly now a Shia majority in the elected assembly, will be moving towards the establishment of an Islamic state. Could you see that as part of a negotiated strategy, or at least an exit strategy on the American and British side?
Well, first of all, I actually don't believe that. I think that the majority of the Shiites actually don't want an Islamic state. I mean, I think it's more an ethnic thing than a religious thing. And I think, you know, Iraq, there are lots of divisions among the religious groups. So I would be really surprised if they succeed. The other thing that actually is very nice about Iraq is that there are very powerful women's movements. 60% of the Iraqi population are women as a result of all these wars, and there is a very active. So I actually don't, in fact, I think that's not one of the big worries. I think Kurdish secession is a bigger worry. But even if it were a worry, I think I would argue, and I'd be interested in what our Iranian colleague thinks, I think I would argue that this is something we'd have to do, because in the end, I don't think you're ever going to deal with Islamism by excluding it. If you look at what's happened in Turkey, it's actually been a very, very good thing for Turkish democracy that the Islamists have come to power. And it was a disaster in Algeria, excluding them. So I think there has to be some engagement with Islamism.
A question from up on the gallery, please.
Thank
yes,
you.
Please.
I understand that your basic argument is that the old methods of warfare and old ways of thinking aren't relevant today to the new threats that we encounter. My question has two parts. First, you overlook the successes, and I'm mainly talking about Afghanistan and Kosovo in terms of RMA thinking. Second, would you accept the premises that in certain regional situations, mainly the Middle East and Southeast Asia, limited and conventional warfare is still very much a relevant thing today? And old wars, as you say, are still very much actually part of our present.
Might expect. If you think about Kosovo, I mean, I feel that the Kosovo war was very ambiguous, because I was strongly in favor of intervening to protect the Kosovar Albanians, but I felt that bombing was absolutely the wrong way to do it. And I think that ambiguity has left a very terrible legacy. Because actually what happened is, by doing bombing, the Americans in fact allowed Milosevic to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of the Kosovar Albanians. Now, of course, they did succeed. In the end, Milosevic capitulated, and the Kosovar Albanians came back, and they were liberated. And that's why, actually, in the end, I decided on balance, it was the right thing to have done. But at the same time, the result of that was reverse ethnic cleansing of Serbs, and an incredible long-term problem. It also exacerbated Serbian nationalism. And I think we've still got a terrible long-term problem in the region. And I think I would make a similar argument about Afghanistan. I think, yes, it was very good to destroy the training camps. That was a good thing. But nevertheless, you know, they, you know, not managing to deal with the warlords, not managing to deal with the public security, has left us with big problems in Afghanistan. So I have mixed feelings about that. And I find it very, very difficult to see any situations where classic conventional warfare is really useful. Now, as I said, I mean, I didn't really have time to elaborate it. I still do think there's a role for military force, and I've given a lot of thought to how military force might be used. If you ask me, for example, about Iraq, I think we should have intervened in 1991 when the Shias rose up against Saddam Hussein to protect them, as we did in northern Iraq. And it was a big success, actually. I think northern Iraq was one of the biggest successes for humanitarian intervention. I think there could have been a case for keeping forces on the borders of Iraq in order to put pressure on Saddam Hussein to accept weapons inspectors and others, but I won't go into all that. And to argue that the reason the troops were there was, in fact, to be there to protect people in the event of a similar uprising. And protecting people is very different. If you went in and protected the Shias against Saddam's attacks, then it would be up to them to establish a new form of government rather than you coming in and establishing your own administrative system.
See, we had a question down here. Yes, please, and then I'll take the last question over there.
On the theoretical level of distinction between the new and the old wars, the way I've understood the lecture you just gave is that the main difference actually lies in the destructive and constructive, to say it in a way, power of old versus new wars. Now I wonder, in the case of old wars, if this is the distinction, which is, as I said before, the way, I mean, that at least the one you accentuated the most, if this is the distinction, I think there are plenty of examples, and it's logically very easy to think of the destructive power of old wars just as you can see them in the new ones. If there's no dividing line on the theoretical level between the new and the old based on the destructive versus constructive power, what would you base this distinction at all? And if not, and talking about all the imaginary power of rhetoric in the case of war and terror, is it this whole discourse on new wars also in danger of becoming a misnomer because of its imaginary power? I mean, it's welcome because of its imaginary power, but it just as the war on terror might be, but it can also end up being as it is.
Really, you've asked me two questions. And on the first question, I think all wars are actually both constructive and destructive. And I suppose what I'm saying is that the difference between new wars and old wars is that they construct and destroy different things. I think old wars, again, in this idealized version that I've constructed, did contribute to statehood. But they were also immensely destructive. That was the point I was trying to make. They killed millions of people. And so they consolidated state power. In that sense, they were constructive. New states, I do think, they're obviously also very destructive, although the scale of destruction is not equivalent to old wars. They do construct new power relations, just as old wars do, rather horrible. They construct a new kind of criminalized extremist political economy. They construct new little statements where sort of criminalize extreme nationalists or religious militants gain power. And that could be the future. I mean, that's one model for the future. So I think they're both. Is the new war thing a new myth? Yes, of course it is. And I'm absolutely sure that in a few years' time, somebody will come along and say, thinking this way about new wars is really preventing us. That's how history, every sort of period of history, has its own interpretations. And it's the same of science. You know, you have your own interpretations of science and history, and every so often you have to destroy them, and that's the job of people at the LSE, is to destroy the last generation's idea. You know, we invented the welfare state, then we invented the free market, now we're all into globalization.
That's what we do. That's how we get that's how we get our funding. Last question over there.
Just a very quick comment and then a question on your Kosovo the Kosovo case, because I was actually going to ask a question about the Kosovo case. From my extensive experience with victims of war from Kosovo during the Kosovo war itself, I don't know of any Albanian Kosovar that would agree with you that the bombing campaign was not the right one. Even though there were Albanian casualties during the campaign of NATO, they still feel very strongly that that was the best strategy that was used, and they would argue very much for the brilliance of this intervention in Kosovo that has saved, it killed hundreds of civilians, but it saved hundreds of thousands of other people that now are able to have an assembly or a small parliament and hopefully are going towards a more hopeful future, not only for Kosovo, but for the whole region of the Balkans itself. So I would have to disagree with you on that one, but just a question on the terminology of the old wars and how the Bush administration is using them or has used them to create an imaginary or kind of, you know, fictional war in the minds of the American people. What would you have done had you been the president of the United States of America on September 11th? I mean, because it is quite a difficult choice, you know, when 3,000 people die. What would have gone through your mind, and
what did go through my mind. But first, just on Kosovo, you get me wrong. I mean, that's what I said. I said I actually did support the war. Although, and those were precisely the reasons. But I actually think that the way it was done was very problematic and had all kinds of consequences. So I was in favor of the ends but not the means. And I think one thing you must remember is that during the bombing, nobody really knew whether Milosevic was going to capitulate. And at that time, when my Kosovo Albanian friends rang me up, they were completely terrified. So they were very frustrated because they wanted ground troops in Kosovo, and the Americans had ruled that out. And I think had the Americans been willing to commit ground troops, Holbrooke would have had a much stronger position in the negotiations that led up to it. So that's on Kosovo. On what would I have done on September 11th? Well, the first thing I would have done is, instead of saying this is Pearl Harbor, I would have said this is a crime against humanity. And I would have immediately, well, he did go to the United Nations. But I would have said it's not just against America, it's against all the nationalities that are in the Twin Towers, and we must all do something about it. And I would have said this is a moment for a kind of new global social contract. Mm. This is a moment when civil society must mobilize. We mustn't allow these guys to divide Christians and Muslims. This is a moment when we must really do show that we do redistribution. All of these kinds of things. I'd have used it, actually, for a quite different agenda. And I actually did think, for one, I mean, I was completely naive, I have to say, that I thought maybe that was a possibility because it was real. And I think that's how people in New York felt. But, you know, most people around me, particularly my American friends, said, don't be ridiculous, this is what they're going to do.
And they did. Thank you very much, Mary. It's a fascinating lecture. which again proved exactly what we are trying to do with this lecture series, and that it is possible to link the present with the past and to draw, if not lessons, at least some of the inferences for what has gone before up to the situation today. We will continue that process 2 weeks from now when my beloved co-director, Mick Cox, and I will be refighting the Cold War, slightly controlled by David Held, in this room. So that's on the 16th of February, a roundtable discussion with Mick Cox and myself on so-called lessons from the Cold War for the War on Terror, Wednesday, 16th February, here in the Old Theatre. Thank you all very much.
Do you admit disagreement?
I'm sorry.
I mean, does he still think this?